Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last night, barbecues and fireworks celebrated America's independence and the American creed of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, a unique idea 228 years ago, laid down by a unique man. Thomas Jefferson, revolutionary, visionary, slaveholder. Tonight on Point, on Independence Day weekend, Thomas Jefferson and the Jeffersonian ideals, then and now. But first, U.S. aircraft attacked a purported insurgent safe house in Fallujah today, killing at least 10 people. Iraqi interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi issued an unprecedented statement saying his government provided intelligence to the U.S. military for the attack. The strike came hours after the interim government suddenly postponed an announcement of its own new security plans for dealing with Iraq's continuing insurgency. Farnaz Fasihi is a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal in Baghdad. I asked her what was behind the delay.
I think that they want to make sure that whatever precautions they take and whatever emergency laws they implement are going to be manageable and acceptable by the Americans, because at the end of the day, security is still the responsibility of the coalition forces, or multinational forces, as they're now called. The new government is trying very hard to say that they have authority and they're going to be in control, but I think that they're trying to hash out some of those details.
They've been announcing press conferences where they were going to unveil the details, and each time, at the very last minute, they've canceled. Do you take from that that the U.S. authorities are objecting to their plans?
I don't think they're so much objecting. I think that they're just trying to agree on what exactly to do and how to implement it. They haven't said that they're necessarily going to unveil the plans. I mean, they hint at it, but they haven't directly said that they're going to do this. So there's a lot of anticipation about that here on the ground. And I don't think it's going to be, especially in Baghdad, very harsh measures such as curfew at night. I think they're probably going to declare some sort of a martial law when, in case of emergency, they can declare it for maybe a couple of days or a week here and there around the country, and then lift it, put it in place and lift it as they please, because it would just handicap the city if they were to put curfews and martial laws in place all around.
We also read that they want to reinstate the death penalty and offer temporary amnesty, a window of amnesty to insurgents.
That's right.
Why these two?
The new government, ever since it's taken office, has tried very hard to come across forceful to the Iraqi people, because security, in every public opinion poll that's been taken in Iraq, whether by Iraqis, by radios, or by Americans and CPA, security ranks as the number one concern. And that's what they are expecting. When asked, what do you want from the new government, all Iraqis unanimously say, we want security. We want to feel safe when we leave our home. And I think that the new government's taking very strong measures to come across as responding to that and trying to gain acceptance from the public, if you may.
So what kind of insurgent would be offered amnesty? The people who have been, just in the last few days, firing on U.S. a medical helicopter, a bomb in Basra, in Mosul, this kind of insurgent that's been actively opposing U.S. and Iraqi authorities, or something else?
I think it would be pretty much widespread. I mean, the Prime Minister said even amnesty for people who have killed Americans or have attacked coalition forces. Now, what this would mean, particularly for the detainees, would be interesting, because as it is, the detainees that the Americans are holding are held on because they're suspect of being a threat to the coalition forces. So whether this amnesty will include them, whether it will include people in Fallujah, still remains to be seen. But again, I think this is one measure of this new government sort of reaching out its hand and saying, please, let's move on, and perhaps the insurgents will give up. I highly doubt it. I think that they're trying to show a gesture of goodwill, but I doubt that the other side is really going to stop fighting.
And for now, just a last question on that. It's only been 1 week since the new government took the reins officially from U.S. Yeah. authorities there. Is it becoming any clearer who is behind the continuing attacks on Americans and Iraqi authorities there?
I don't think it's become any clearer in this past week, but I think that over the past couple of months, it's become clear that it's a wide variety of people. It isn't so black and white as the Americans like to label it, especially the military here, calling them Zaghawi's people or necessarily foreign fighters. I think it is some foreign fighters in places like Fallujah. It is Shia militants in places like Najaf and Saddam loyalists. And it is a general public that are joining resistance because the occupation was growing more and more unpopular, and many people just felt like they had to do something and join resistance and fight. So I think it's a combination of all those people.
And 1 week into this government's tenure, do you sense Iraqis being any more hopeful, or does it feel like before the handover?
I think a lot more hopeful. You could feel the Iraqis being hopeful almost immediately after the handover. They feel like their own people are in charge. And they're actually applauding and responding very well to the prime minister's forceful measures. These are people who were ruled by a dictator for 30 years. That dictator offered them security, for better or worse. So I had heard it from people all the past year and a half that, you know, we need a forceful, strong man to rule Iraq and be able to curb security. And they see that person in the prime minister, and I think that's working to his advantage. And people are seeming a lot more positive about things.
After so much insecurity, bring on the strong hand. What a conclusion.
Right, absolutely.
Farnaz Fasili, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Farnaz Fasili is a correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. She spoke with us from Baghdad. It's the end of a long Independence Day weekend, and tonight we're taking a close look at the man who 228 years ago penned the Declaration of Independence. Thomas Jefferson, one of the most complex and controversial of the founding fathers. He saw excellence in Jesus, but drew a strict line between church and state. He didn't trust big government, but doubled the size of the United States with the Louisiana Purchase. He wrote that all men are created equal, but was a slave owner and won the presidential election of 1800 in part on the backs of African Americans, then counted as only 3/5 of a person by the U.S. Constitution. Thomas Jefferson was a visionary founder of American democracy, even as he flouted his own vision. Tonight on Point, Thomas Jefferson and the Jeffersonian ideal then and now. Has America achieved the democracy that Thomas Jefferson envisioned? Does it still uphold that vision? Does what we know now about Jefferson and slavery diminish him or make this founding father somehow more human? And have Americans held on to the ideal of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Does it mean today what it meant to Jefferson then? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Christopher Farley, senior editor at Time Magazine and director of their July 5th special issue, The Radical Mind of Thomas Jefferson. Good evening and welcome, Christopher Farley.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
It's great to have you. It was a great section. And joining us as well from Williamstown, Massachusetts, is Susan Dunn, professor of humanities at Williams College and author of Jefferson's Second Revolution, The Election Crisis of 1800. Susan Dunn, wonderful to have you.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
It's great to have you both. We want to dig in with each of you tonight and to a bit of where we stand if Thomas Jefferson could cast his eye across the American democracy in the year 2004, there's enough going on that makes us curious, especially curious about that right now. But Chris Farley, if I could go to you first, just for a reintroduction to this man, for those who read their history books too quickly or not at all, remind us of who Thomas Jefferson was in his time.
Well, Thomas Jefferson was the man that wrote the Declaration of Independence. He had some help in writing it, and some of the parts were edited by Ben Franklin, that part where he writes, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." At first, that was actually sacred and undeniable, and Jefferson and Ben Franklin sort of cut that out and said, "We should put self-evident in there," and so that phrase has now since become famous, of course.
Nice and clean. Good to have editors once in a while.
It certainly is.
John Adams had a hand in that as well.
Yes, and he was a man that served as president 2 times. He was a man that considered himself somewhat of a pacifist, but when push came to shove, made war against the Barbary Coast states. He was a man that, as you mentioned before, was against slavery, but yet could not see himself getting rid of slaves in his own life, in his own personal life, and that will be forever a mark against him. He's someone that I think reminds us that someone who had high ideals, but some ideas that we look at now as repugnant. So he's a man of many, many contradictions. I think that makes him fascinating for people to look back on today.
Susan Dunn, when we look down at Monticello, a wonderful place to visit, and there he is in his kind of palace of the Enlightenment on the hilltop in Virginia. He comes across, in a way, as the original kind of American aristocrat, at least aristocrat of the mind, and yet aristocracy was one of his perpetual phobias.
Yes, that's one of the many contradictions in Jefferson, that he was a patrician. His mother was a Randolph, one of the distinguished Virginia families. And yet he took issue with the elitism that he felt the Hamiltonian and Washington Federalists represented. And he wanted to be a man of the people and speak for the people, not that he necessarily knew much about the people.
You describe his election of the year to the presidency in 1800, which was bitterly contested and very difficult. Makes the year 2000 election look, I don't know, you tell me, but in your description it looks relatively tame, as a real turning point in America's understanding of democracy and a two-party system. What happened in 1800, Susan Dunn?
In 1800, Jefferson was running against John Adams for the presidency, and he won. His party definitely beat Adams. But the problem was that because of a strange way that they voted in the Electoral College, Jefferson tied with his own running mate, Aaron Burr.
And awkward, to say the least.
Extremely awkward, and made more awkward because Burr was playing a strange double game. He felt at one moment he would say that he knew that he was going to be the vice president, and at another moment he would say the opposite, that he had every right to be president too. And the tie took several months to be worked out in the House of Representatives, and during those few months all hell broke loose. There was preparation for blocking the election, for putting in another Federalist candidate, for Adams appointing other John Jay as or John Marshall, and all kinds of shenanigans were going on, including preparation for secession and civil war if the Federalists blocked Jefferson from coming to power.
And in the process of that struggle, American politics broke in half, broke into distinct parties, and accepted that for the first time.
Well, the parties had been evolving in the 1790s, but this election was finally an election in which one party ultimately willingly, transferred power to their enemies, to the opposition. And I say in my book that that's really the final stage in the American Revolution. We have the War of Independence, which is only one fraction of the revolution. Then we have the Constitutional Convention in 1787. Then we have another, perhaps more important step, the Bill of Rights in 1791. But there's one thing that's still missing, and that's the principle of the legitimacy of opposition, that in a democracy you can organize and oppose those who govern and work to oust them. And I think that really is the most precious lesson in a democracy. Because in all the years that you had the Soviet Union, it was what they called laughingly a one-party democracy.
Right.
Or China today, a one-party democracy.
Well, it's always the most difficult lesson to learn, that a democracy means sharing power and sometimes giving up power.
Exactly.
We're going to look more at Jefferson's ideals, but this slaveholding factor was crucial in his view of America, the economy, Christopher Farley, and in our understanding of him today. How large were his slaveholdings?
Well, at the time of his death, he had over 200 slaves, and he also even sort of betrayed some of the promises he had made during his life. He, according to two of his slaves, he had actually made a promise to Sally Hemings to free her upon his death, and nowhere in his will or writings does he actually say she will be freed upon his death. And so in the end, she served there a little bit longer afterwards, after he died. She was not released from his service after his death.
And, of course, the recent DNA tests indicate that, in fact, he probably did have at least one child, one son by her. Christopher Farley, Susan Dunn, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the man who wrote the heart of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson. Does what we know now about Jefferson, about Sally Hemings and his slaveholdings, diminish him or add to his humanity? Have Americans held on to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? What does pursuit of happiness mean today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the man who wrote the heart of the Declaration of Independence, about Jeffersonian ideals then and now, about Jeffersonian hypocrisy then and now. My guests are Christopher Farley. He's a senior editor at Time Magazine, and with joining us from New York, and with us from Williamstown, Massachusetts, Susan Dunn, professor of humanities at Williams College, author of the forthcoming book, Jefferson's Second Revolution. You can join us as well. Is the country tilting toward Jeffersonian democracy or toward rule by an elite, his nightmare? And what is the modern equivalent of Jefferson's yeoman farmer, of the farm as the base of Republican virtue? Has the United States achieved the democracy Jefferson envisioned, or has it even come close? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Susan Dunn, I wish you would define for us this Jeffersonian democracy. Americans talk about it all the time, but I'm not sure they understand exactly how radical that could be in some dimensions. How do you understand the term and what it suggested, what it meant?
I think it simply means self-government. Jefferson talked about what he called ward republics, W-A-R-D, ward republics. And that meant that each locality, each township, would itself constitute a kind of republic, so that power was diffused, and power sharing and self-government is diffused throughout the society on every level, on the federal level, the state level, county, local, down to juries. He felt that the jury system was, in fact, one of the most important backbones of democracy and a school for democracy, getting citizens to participate in their own judicial system. Mm-hmm. So I think Jeffersonian democracy simply means a real commitment and dedication to self-government by all of us, a real participation in the government of our communities and states and nation.
But he saw this as opposed, Christopher Farley, to the Federalists and their vision of American democracy.
Yeah, I think it's really instructive to understand Jefferson's ideas about government by opposing them with Alexander Hamilton's. You know, Alexander Hamilton, you know, favored a strong federal government. Jefferson was someone who really advocated states' rights. Jefferson really saw the country as sort of an agrarian country, a country where farmers would really sort of, you know, rule themselves. And Hamilton really wanted a country where the economy was strong and trade and finance really were what pushed the country along. And it's those two ideas about what America should be about, which really, I think, helped propel American democracy throughout the ages. I think we live more in a Hamiltonian society than we do in a Jeffersonian society, but I think that Jefferson maybe won our hearts and Hamilton won our heads.
I feel that so strongly, Susan, and I think many Americans do. The allure of Jefferson is so powerful. The yeoman farmers, and as you say, people directly involved in their democracy. And yet, is it possible that Hamiltonian was ultimately the realist, kind of an awful word, and yet one that tends to win out very often? Did Hamiltonian just understand how power and economics work more accurately, less idealistically, perhaps?
Absolutely. I think that Jefferson was not interested in having America be a powerful nation state like Great Britain. He didn't want that kind of country. It was Hamilton who was really a modernist and a statist, wanting to build a powerful country with a powerful military and a powerful economy and a powerful manufacturing base. And Jefferson didn't want that. He wanted a more laid-back, agrarian nation in which people were simply free to be intellectuals.
You know, sometimes they say be careful what you dream because you may get it. The country ultimately went down Hamilton's path. Was Jefferson's dream a possibility if Americans had embraced it more fervently? Could we be living in a Jeffersonian democracy today? Or with all of your studies, Susan Dunn, do you think that is a kind of always out of reach vision of democracy?
I think it was partly an anti-modern vision, this agrarian nation without a national bank, with little manufacturing. And Jefferson ultimately in the 1820s was even ambivalent about what they called at the time internal improvements, which meant federal subsidies for roads and canals. I think this would have been a kind of New Zealand. Well, I've never been to New Zealand or Australia, but I imagine that this would be a kind of backwater to some extent country, certainly not a military country or an economic power.
Christopher Farley, he had very mixed feelings about military power, about a standing military at all.
Well, certainly that's true. Hamilton wanted the U.S. to have a professional federal army, and Jefferson wanted the country to rely on state militias. But the interesting thing is Hamilton always thought if Jefferson became president, he probably would, you know, see things the other way, see that having a strong central power was really the only way you could really control and rule the country. And in the end, Jefferson did sort of come over to the Hamilton side on several important issues. Louisiana Purchase, nothing in the Constitution allowed for that. He made it because it was a good deal for America. And the war against the Barbary States. Jefferson saw that they were preying on American shipping, and decided it would be a good thing to do to really unleash the power of the U.S. military to shut down these pirates who were preying on shipping. And so the pacifist Jefferson became really sort of the Hamiltonian chief executive.
He went out, formed the U.S. Marines, and went after the Barbary pirates. Susan Dunn, what about this core phrase at the heart of what we recall of Thomas Jefferson on the 4th of July, Independence Day, the pursuit of happiness, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? This was a man of the Enlightenment. We're no longer exactly in that period. What did he mean by the pursuit of happiness?
Well, Arthur Schlesinger's father has a very important article about the pursuit of happiness, and he talks about it as being the practice of happiness. Just as a lawyer might say, I'm pursuing the law, we would be pursuing happiness and practicing happiness. Now, what does that mean? Probably a combination of individual freedom, public welfare, and the common good.
Did it mean a big Cadillac and a vacation house? He was clearly a materialist at some level. Monticello's a heck of a material expression. Today it seems very often to mean an affluent lifestyle or the pursuit of an affluent lifestyle.
No, he and Washington both spoke about pursuit of happiness, and they didn't see it in terms of materialism or luxury, although, as you point out, Jefferson and Washington both liked to order the best wines and all kinds of antiques from Europe for their homes. But materialism wasn't the value. It was something much more moral and something much more connected to freedom and a life of the mind.
Christopher Farley, that seems to describe something like the pursuit of happiness as the moral development of the self. Do you share that reading? And have we lost that reading in our political discourse today?
Well, again, this, I think, shows another one of Jefferson's contradictions. He was a man that saw himself as leading the life of a mind. He had a huge library. His donation to the U.S. after the Library of Congress burned down really helped reform that library's collections. And yet he did like the finer things in life. He lived beyond his means. He was a man who, when he died, his estate was deeply in debt. He's a guy that part of the reason he didn't give up his slaves, it seems, is because he realized that he really couldn't get along without them. He couldn't live the lifestyle he was accustomed to without them. So he believed in the pursuit of happiness, I think, on a very personal level, a very luxury-oriented level, even if in his writings and in his philosophy he sort of talked about other more sort of highfalutin concepts as well. He certainly lived a very happy life.
And died broke, more than broke, died in debt. Chris Farley, Susan Dunn, please stand by. I want to begin to welcome our callers, and a lot of them are waiting to join us. Dana's calling from South Wellfleet, Massachusetts. Hi, Dana, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening
good to evening.
All of you. I would like to go back to the basic principles attributed to Jefferson. I would just like to say, yes, he did lay down some very high-minded ideals. However, I think history has shown us that they, you know, for people, non-whites, women, laborers, you know, the working movement, they didn't get their rights bestowed upon them by a wise old Jeffersonian father or a Washington or a Hamilton. They had to fight for them. They had to go beyond the extent of the law very often and had to fight for those rights. That's why whatever rights blacks or women may enjoy today, or, you know, and other people who still fight. They had to fight from the ground up, often had the power of the state, you know.
In opposition. So you're saying don't curl up at the feet of a statue of Thomas Jefferson and think everything will be fine.
No, because history has shown otherwise. And, I mean, I believe in Jeffersonian's ideals. I'm even a Federalist myself. I mean, I believe in federal government. I do.
Well, but then Jefferson was, as Susan Dunn says, he wanted to see democracy really practiced most vigorously at a much more local level.
But it doesn't have any teeth at a local level because, and you could have some states, like in Switzerland, there are some what they call cantons that don't allow women to vote. But the federal government here ensures that women will have the right to vote, that states can't make that. States' rights would have promoted slavery in those days, and a federal government, you know, once the people rebelled enough, had enough political teeth behind it. And it's the federal government today that theoretically ensures, you know, not only rights for humans, but even the national park system made me a real believer in federal government, because if we let the state run the National Park Service, it'd be developed by, there'd be condominiums all along.
So you want to see that federal power at some level, and yet you want it in the interest of a certain agenda. You've raised a lot of interesting points there, Dana. Thanks for calling. Susan Dunn, what about it? First, on the issue of Jefferson and what he expected of American citizens in future generations in terms of whether or not they would simply rely on the founders to have framed up the house of democracy for all time. And then on this point of the tension between local democracy and the sometimes efficacy of federal government.
Well, on your first point about the Constitution, Jefferson was very much a believer in the flexibility of the Constitution. He didn't see the Constitution as something engraved in stone. He even went so far as to say that every 19 years, he chose the number 19 because he thought a generation consisted of about 19 years, mm-hmm. every 19 years, Americans should review their Constitution with an eye to transforming it and adjusting it and modifying it. And he explained that by saying the earth belongs to the living, not to the dead. So he would have been in favor of changing the Constitution to meet the needs and the demands of the day. Vote for blacks, vote for women. But your caller was quite right that equal votes for equal rights for black citizens or for women wasn't even on the radar screen for him. That was absolutely inconceivable to him. Also, I agree with your caller that Jefferson viewed freedom as freedom from government, not freedom through government. And I think that idea of freedom through government, what was really FDR's Four Freedoms, mm-hmm. or the Civil Rights Act, for instance, of 1964, that's freedom through government. And that's much more Hamiltonian than Jeffersonian, who simply wanted to get government off our backs.
So if you imagine, I mean, we all know the course that states' rights took, and of course ended up in opposition not only to the Civil War but to the Civil Rights Movement. From your reading of Jefferson's copious letters, where do you think he would ultimately have ended up? Was he a bone-deep racist and pro-slavery guy? I mean, he likened black Americans to orangutans at one point, if I recall correctly. Or was a man of his intellect bound to come around to a fuller vision of democracy, more inclusive?
On race, he was probably the most racist of the founders. Hamilton and Washington, I think, believed that with education, slaves could develop themselves and become equal. And ironically, although Jefferson had an affair with his slave and fathered children with his slave, I think that he was the most hostile to equal rights. But I think that none of them at the time could conceive of a biracial society. It just wasn't on the screen for them. They thought that, yes, there should be eventually emancipation, but they thought that African Americans would have to be deported and what they called colonized and sent either to the Caribbean or to Africa.
Right. And, of course, he died long before it took place, but there must have been speculation about where Thomas Jefferson would have come down on the Civil War, whether he would have followed his nose for local democracy and states' rights in support of a Confederacy, ultimately.
Well, I think it's not completely clear. The words that he spoke against the Sedition Act in 1798 These were two resolutions called the Kentucky and Virginia Resolutions against the Sedition Act and saying that states had the right to nullify federal laws that they didn't like. Those words from the Kentucky and Virginia Resolutions became a kind of mantra for states' rights secessionists. But it's a question how much Jefferson really believed that states could secede. That still isn't clear, and historians are still puzzled by it and still debating that.
Ken is calling from Needham, Massachusetts. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah,
I wanted to call and offer a bit of a defense for Jefferson and the founders on the slavery issue and do it from the standpoint of people who were much closer to being his contemporaries. And if I could, I'd like to just quote what Lincoln had said about the Declaration and therefore Jefferson.
Okay.
They intended to include all men, but they did not intend to declare all men equal in all respects. They did not mean to assert the obvious untruth, that all were actually enjoying that equality, nor that they were about to confer it immediately upon them. They meant simply to declare the right so that the enforcement of it might follow as fast as circumstances should permit. And I think, you know, when they were 50 years or 60 years or 70 years away from the event, that Lincoln and other contemporaries had a different view than a lot of historians do today.
Right, so a lot of evolution in those years, and it raises the issue of whether Jefferson would have evolved right along with it. Let us pick that up. Our time is short before the break, but Ken, thanks for your call. Christopher Farley, how about it? Do we hear there Abraham Lincoln, the revisionist, twisting Jefferson in part there to his own Civil War era agenda, or do you hear what do you think? Is that an accurate reading of Thomas Jefferson?
Well, to a certain extent, we have to give the Founding Fathers some credit that they created documents that were better than they were, that allowed the country to become better than they were, and that is part of their genius. But we can't let them off the hook entirely. You know, George Washington, Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, they were all slaveholders, and people can write them off and say, oh, well, there were men of their time, but there were men of their time who had better ideas than that. Alexander Hamilton, for example, he was against slavery, and he actually believed that Africans and African Americans could have the same intellectual capabilities as white men. And certainly he lived at the same time as Jefferson. Jefferson could have held those beliefs had he been as forward-thinking as Alexander Hamilton. Thomas Jefferson was also confronted on the subject by Benjamin Banneker, who was a black genius who helped to survey the site where Washington, D.C. now is. He wrote Thomas Jefferson on the score, challenged his views on black people, and Thomas Jefferson never really understood where Benjamin Banneker was coming from, never really internalized his arguments. So he had the chance to change. He failed to take it. And I think that's one reason we have to see Jefferson as a flawed founding father, not as complete as a complete sort of American hero.
Flawed, but great. Christopher Farley, Susan Dunn, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the man who wrote the heart of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson. Are we the inspired visionary nation of Jefferson's hopes? Is there still a place for the philosopher president? Can you imagine having one? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the man who wrote the heart of the Declaration of Independence, talking about Jeffersonian ideals then and now, Jeffersonian hypocrisy then and now. My guests are Christopher Farley, senior editor at Time Magazine, joining us from New York City, and from Williamstown, Massachusetts, Susan Dunn, professor of humanities at Williams College, author of Jefferson's Second Revolution, The Election Crisis of 1800. You can join us as well. Have Americans held on to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? What does the pursuit of happiness mean today? Has the country achieved the democracy Jefferson envisioned? Has it come close? And have we moved too far from the age of reason, from the Enlightenment, to produce another Jefferson? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. JC's calling. Hi, JC. You're on the air.
Oh, Tom. Good evening.
Hi.
A question for Professor Dunn.
Yeah.
I'm wondering whether maybe there might not be a solution to this apparent contradiction in Jefferson between his ideals and his slaveholding in something to do with an issue of a political economy. And this was triggered by what you said earlier about his anti-modernism,
mm-hmm.
thinking particularly about the role of money. I mean, historically, the historical origins of money are sort of found in the sovereignty of the state, and only in a Hamiltonian sense, an authority can overcome the anarchy of barter and, you know, the uniform account of measure in an agrarian economy. So my question is Jefferson sort of trapped in a vision of barter and an agrarian economy that's retrograde, and that he can't really acknowledge the role of money, and therefore the role of labor and sharecropping and so forth are sort of consistent with his slaveholding?
Let us pick it up. Susan Dunn.
I think to some extent that's definitely true. Later on in the 18-teens, after the War of 1812, then Jefferson does start to see the value of a bank, precisely at the time when the charter of the First National Bank has expired, and when he sees that the country needs to develop a manufacturing base and does need to be independent of products from Europe. But basically, I think that you're right, that there is a longing in Jefferson for a pre-modern agrarian economy. One of the reasons that he's ambivalent about emancipation, even though he's always talking about the evils of slavery, one of the reasons that he's actually ambivalent is because so much of the wealth of his own state, Virginia, which he sometimes calls his country, is in slaves. And so it's really a question also of the wealth of Virginians. Their property is human property, and that kind of necessitates a whole pre-modern way of thinking about economics.
So maybe put the blinkers on him. It's incredible to think of such a far-thinking man not perceiving, as Hamilton clearly did, a much more industrial future and its implications. How do you keep dreaming about the agrarian farmer, as lovely as that might be?
He felt that that was what the whole American Revolution had really been about. He refers to the spirit of 76, and that's a spirit of freedom, of independence, of state sovereignty, of freedom from European entanglements.
And he thought the continent would never be filled up, never be overcrowded, a farm for everybody, essentially.
Oh, absolutely. When he went through with the Louisiana Purchase, he said, now we will have land for the thousands and thousands generation. So this was definitely his dream.
I guess, there you go, even a genius can only see so far. Chris Farley, your crew wrote, Walter Curran wrote in Time magazine, there isn't much about today's America that its visionary third president, that is Jefferson, wouldn't find troubling, in need of improvement, or just plain horrifying. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think, one, he would be horrified by the education system, because he was someone who believed strongly in education, founded the University of Virginia, and I think he might be horrified by...
What's the problem with today's education system, then?
Well, by the fact that there's not as much money as might be spent on education, public education, as perhaps Jefferson might have liked. Again, this is all guesswork, because
okay. You
can never be certain what Jefferson would have thought. You can only sort of guess by his writing.
But you've got a pretty big statement here in Time magazine, so give us more to back it up.
Yeah, I think he also might... It's hard to tell what he would think about the war on terror. On one level, of course, he did go after the Barbary States. On the other level, he was someone that really believed in conservation, in having the federal government live within its means. And so you might wonder, what would he think of the vast outlays of cash it might take to conduct that kind of war? Certainly he had those debates with John Adams during the time he was thinking about whether or not the U.S. should spend any money to go after the Barbary Coast states. That was one of his concerns. Will this cost more money to go after them than it will to sort of just pay them off and live with their attack?
So he wasn't instinctively aggressive in that way, but rather would balance it. Susan Dunn, I know it's an incredibly speculative exercise, but if the great man could walk among us now, what do you think? How would he respond to... What would he respond to and what he'd see in the American democracy, American circumstances?
Well, on the question of education, I think that Chris is, of course, right, that he'd be disappointed. But at least he could be comforted by the fact that we have public education, because in his day there wasn't public education. Massachusetts was beginning to have it, and so were some other New England states. Virginia didn't have public education until the 1850s.
Mm-hmm.
He and Madison both wanted complete separation of church and state, and I mean complete, absolute.
And he might be concerned about the overlapping there now. What about the issue he always came back to of elites and the aristocracy? Would he see the United States as sufficiently, power sufficiently diffused or not?
I guess he would have been appalled by all of the money in campaigns and corporate contributions. And in general, I think he probably would have been dismayed by the disparity of income. He wanted a redistribution of wealth, and he did want a kind of leveling.
And why did he want that?
So, because he saw America, for the most part, as a community, and in which citizens have to be equal. You can't have one social class so wealthy that they're almost isolated in their gated communities from the rest of the citizens.
Because?
Because then we're no longer codependent. Citizens have to be interdependent, woven together in a society in which we are really bound in fraternity. The word fraternity comes from the French Revolution, and Jefferson, of course, was a passionate fan of the French Revolution. And I think he did believe, though, in that kind of fraternity, and that fraternity calls for what he called leveling. And what Benjamin Franklin referred to as mediocrity of fortune. He didn't really mean that everybody should be poor, but that there should be some means, middle point.
We've got a lot of gated communities to stand in front of today if Thomas Jefferson walked again. What an interesting conversation. I hope we can pick it up again sometime. Susan Dunn, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're so welcome.
Susan Dunn, professor of humanities at Williams College, author of Jefferson's Second Revolution, The Election Crisis of 1800. And Christopher Farley, thanks for the Time Magazine edition, and thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Christopher Farley, senior editor at Time Magazine. In a moment, reflections on America's mortality. This is On Point. With fireworks, parades, and concerts, the nation celebrated its 228th birthday yesterday. New York City saw the nation's largest July 4th pyrotechnics display following a solemn ceremony earlier in the day when a 20-ton slab of granite was placed as the cornerstone of the skyscraper that will replace the destroyed World Trade Center towers. In Washington, rain washed out the Independence Day parade, but the fireworks on the National Mall went on as planned. While this long 4th of July weekend is a time to honor the country and the glory of its founding and ideals, writer James Carroll is reminded that nothing lasts forever. Here is James Carroll reading his essay entitled Intimations of America's Mortality.
We celebrate beginnings, whether of persons or nations, as a way of honoring our place in time. The joyful rituals of July 4th, observed nowhere more happily than in Boston, remind us of the day on which our country came into being. This week we feast on summer food, listen to patriotic music, send up flares, and perhaps choke for a moment on the high emotion of love for this country. But to acknowledge that the United States of America has a beginning and is thus bound by the rules of time is implicitly to recall that this nation will equally have an end. What the 4th of July celebrates at bottom is American mortality. Like every birthday celebration, it defies the human temptation to imagine oneself as living forever. There is a time past when we did not exist, and there is a time future when, again, we will not exist. To remember the one is to anticipate the other. And everything America accomplishes and signifies must be measured finally against this radical transience within which it all occurs. What could be more obvious, you ask? And yet the truth of our national mortality eludes us. The ultimate demise of the United States is deeply unsettling, even if only in prospect. This is more true of our nation, perhaps, than of others, precisely because we define ourselves in terms more of the future than the past. The greatness of Britain or Greece is tied to what it was, which is why immigrants to those countries, not sharing the past, take on national identity with difficulty. American greatness is always tied to what the nation is becoming, which is why immigrants here feel readily commissioned to create that greatness. The American future belongs equally to everyone. But what if the future is finite? Which is another way of asking about death. At Gettysburg, Lincoln suggested that our hallowed dead will not have died in vain. Only if, in the future, the great task remaining before us is accomplished. Lincoln thus gave voice to a basic American assumption that present experience is justified only by future outcomes. But if ever the Union perishes from the earth, will all those who died for it in the past have died in vain? In a world that remains bound by the rules of time and mortality, no matter how cloaked by patriotic fervor, is the characteristically American idea of boundlessness inevitably self-defeating? If America has defined the future as its only absolute, what happens when the future, too, is revealed as relative? This forward-looking ideology has been an engine of industry and social justice, but is it nevertheless built on a contradiction? And why shouldn't Americans have looked for ways to avoid the bite of such questions? Enter God. Here is the context in which to understand the use to which we have put our civic religion. When we claim to be a nation under God, and it was Lincoln who first used that phrase at Gettysburg, or when we blithely pray, God bless America, assuming that God's blessing for this country is unique, we are appropriating for ourselves divine attributes of infinity and immortality that, in fact, have no place on earth. And notice, we do this, 1863, 1954, 2001, when our future seems most at risk, the American variation on faith in foxholes. Thus, much more is at stake in our public appeals to God than constitutional questions about church and state. Every nation has a way of invoking the divinity, and every army goes into battle under the patronage of some god or other. Nothing new in that. But the American appeal is different because of the function God serves as a solution to the American problem. We yearn to think of ourselves as the indispensable nation, hoping to postpone the inevitable reckoning with an opposite truth for as long as we can. God is our postponement. On this earth, within the limits of time, no nation is indispensable. No nation is forever. When it comes to the human condition, no nation is exceptional. And if one nation is under God, it is only because every nation is. Therefore, the joy with which we celebrate our nation's beginning must inform equally a sense that our nation's eventual end marks us as part of the human family, which remains America's true glory.
James Carroll's op-ed column appears regularly in the Boston Globe. His latest book is Crusade. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.